Welcome to the current federal tax developments for the week of February the 15th, 2021. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state Society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, talking to you this week from Phoenix, and we're going to be talking to you about three developments this week as we look at two court cases and a news release that came out from the IRS during the week. So let's talk about basically our issues this week. We're going to talk about another case came down on the FBAR penalties and how they work, and a taxpayer didn't come out so well with them at the end of this. We also have the tax court explaining its view of when a taxpayer can argue substance over form when they were involved in setting up the transaction. Finally, we'll talk about a warning the IRS put out early in the week regarding a phishing scam where some parties are trying to get EFIN numbers and other information from tax professionals, presumably to help them carry off some scams regarding false tax returns, and then probably also just generic identity theft scams versus the CPA given the information being asked for. So it's kind of an interesting set. So let's go to our first case here, which will be the case of United States versus Collins from the United States District Court for the Western District of Pennsylvania, case number 2:18CV01069. The decision was issued on the 8th of February. And this particular case is going back to the thing we've talked about before, the failure of a taxpayer to file their foreign bank account reporting form, now that 114 that we file electronically with FinCEN every year. And the problem is taxpayers who have, for various reasons, quite often because they didn't want to report the income on the accounts held overseas, so they were hiding things out there, have failed to file that report, failed to give notice. Now, the penalties on failing to do so, it's $10,000, essentially, is the penalty if the failure is not willful. And if the failure is willful, the penalty actually goes up to a maximum of up to $100,000 or one half of the maximum balance in the account, which means it can be fairly substantial on the penalties. And the IRS has had reasonable success arguing that taxpayers who answer no, no on Schedule B at the bottom, that no, they don't have any interest in an offshore bank account, and no, they don't need to file the FBAR forms, that's considered to be willful if you submit a return with that on it, when in fact the answer is yes, you did have the interest. And we should be honest too, let's be very clear, not really an issue in this case, but taxpayers attempting to try to argue that, well, I don't really read the return and the CPA did that, that has failed miserably every time as well. So be aware that those questions are used, and they're used against taxpayers, to go after a rather nasty penalty that is for the willful failure. And answering those questions no, when you actually have such an account, is generally considered to be willful. This particular case involves the IRS looking at proposing civil penalties for 2 years, 2007, 2008. It was the same account. Now, the IRS did not impose a maximum penalty. We'll talk about why not in a second. But essentially, they didn't propose maximum, but they did propose, by the time they got done, over $300,000 in penalty against the taxpayer. And the taxpayer went to court attempting to get those numbers reduced. And the unfortunate side effect, if you read this case, you're going to discover very quickly that it probably made it pretty clear that the taxpayer was not going to win in this case. So let's talk a little bit about that. One of the issues is, the court pointed out that, the taxpayer kept wanting to talk about the fact that had he reported the income from these accounts, he would have owed, even with interest and penalties, far less than this $300,000 that he's being asked to pay as a penalty on this. And he's going to use that to try to argue that the IRS wasn't reasonable in granting mitigation, that the penalty itself is violation of the Eighth Amendment. Also going to try to argue a position that caught on with two courts back in 2018, but has failed since, that the actual maximum penalty, because the IRS has never updated the regulations, is truly capped at $100,000, not 50% of the account. So he's going to try all these arguments. Now, you know, the court said it makes sense, you know, in one sense, in the back of your mind, you may think intuitively, it makes sense to say, well, you know, the penalty shouldn't really be way more than the income tax that would be paid. But the court will tell you why, in fact, it is just fine that the penalty is far more than the tax to be paid, and that's not going to be key. And to be honest, when you take a look at the beginning of this case and you just read the first couple of sections, right, it's, you know, this is one of those cases where they number the paragraphs, and the second paragraph has a bunch of subparts on it. So it goes on for a while. But when you read those, you suddenly realize that the court probably is not going to be very sympathetic. The first thing which it does, the court points out that this is a, quote, sophisticated taxpayer who had a sophisticated understanding of finance, financial obligations, and financial consequences that are far more than an average person. That's going to be bad because it tells you right away the court's not going to buy the theory that, well, I just didn't know. You know, how could I be expected to know something this complicated? They're going to say, nope, this guy, we looked at his history, he's not going to qualify. They also said his actions made it clear that he had an interest in keeping his foreign accounts secret and that he consciously avoided disclosing. And his conduct says that too about that. He had his efforts to avoid receiving an email from UBS, his Swiss bank in the U.S., and he wanted to, in his terms, discreetly transfer money from Switzerland to the U.S. in connection with a mortgage transaction, that is, to try to escape notice. So he took some active steps to escape notice, and then he attempted to argue that this was all justified for various reasons that the court said are objectively unreasonable, including he claimed he filed a Form W-9 with UBS, that he satisfied that's foreign reporting obligations with them, including for all those accounts he didn't file a W-9 for. He claims U.S. Embassy in Paris, sometimes the 70s, told him he didn't have to file with the IRS. He said as long as his foreign banks withheld taxes, he was not obligated to disclose his account to the U.S., although he didn't actually ensure they did withhold anything. Disclosing his accounts to his accountants would increase the cost to perform necessary payment. That's a great defense, right? I'm not going to tell my accountant about my income because it's going to charge me for the, you know, for doing more work on reporting that income. So obviously, you know, that's a reasonable reason to just not report. That sounds an interesting defense. And that Swiss bank secrecy laws precluded him from disclosing his account to his U.S. accountants. And that's not going to get a whole lot of sympathy saying, we don't care about Swiss secrecy laws. We care about U.S. laws. You're violating those. If you're living here, you know, you're living here, a U.S. citizen, our theory is you better pay attention to our laws and not worry so much about Switzerland in this case. So, yeah, it all kind of fell apart on him. And they didn't buy the theory in any event. So, essentially, we find out right at the beginning of this that this is not going to be a sympathetic defendant. And I think, you know, if you are the taxpayer or you are the attorney representing the taxpayer, you get the opinion, you read that, you're pretty much going to say, I can skip the rest. This is not going to turn out well. In fact, I just want to double check that our penalties didn't go up because this doesn't sound good. Now, the court did say basically they have to review the IRS's issues looking to whether or not there was an abuse of discretion. Because the IRS did, in this case, go ahead and actually, you know, used some mitigation guidelines they have to help assist examiners in determining cases where we would not apply the max penalty. And the penalty applied here was way less than the maximum penalty that could have been applied. They were way less than 50% of the high balance on the accounts. And in fact, as the court pointed out, they were even less than if you applied the mitigation guidelines, what the IRS, you know, would have recommended had been, you know, assigned against this individual. And the court basically said, look, the IRS had determined it's clear you had been actively ignoring these accounts, you've been hiding them. You know, the IRS didn't give you the max penalty Congress would have required. They gave you a much smaller penalty. It's like this is all good. You know, this is like, you know, really nothing here seems to us to be an unrealistically high penalty. So we happen to think that your penalties are perfectly reasonable. The IRS did not behave unreasonably. They refused to go and do what's called a de novo review. The taxpayer tried to argue that that should be the standard. The court said, no, not in a case like this. This is not when we start over from scratch and review from scratch the IRS administrative decision. We're just going to say they have a lot of discretion here. We just look for an abuse of discretion. We don't find it in this case. Now, you may remember 2 years ago, we discussed a bit about some cases where courts had decided, two district courts had decided, that the maximum FBAR penalty be limited to $100,000, despite a 2004 law that said the max penalty would be 50% of, you know, the amount involved, 50% of the balance of the account, or $100,000. You know, those be the two maximums. And the problem was, of course, that it says that was max penalty, and the IRS had never updated the regs from the old line that had 50% of the account and capped at $100,000. While two courts bought that and said the IRS needed to change the reg because the reg wasn't inconsistent with the law, since then, as this court points out, nine courts have decided that, in fact, the law change meant Congress intended that reg to be invalidated, and the IRS can treat that reg as invalid. So again, another bad news thing there if you thought maybe that $100,000 rule would come back again. It's not. It's actually been to the Federal Circuit, which also rejected the view. So generally, it's been bad news, shall we say, on that one. So if you're still thinking about that one and those cases from 2018 somehow surviving and allowing you to, you know, have that limited, your client had that, doesn't look good right now. The taxpayer also tried to argue that this was an unreasonable, excessive fine barred by the Eighth Amendment's bar on the excessive fine and cruel and unusual punishments. The court found that was not the case, and the court went through and said, look, first thing is, we're going to tell you that, in fact, this is a civil penalty. This is not a criminal fine. The Eighth Amendment really deals with criminal issues, not civil. But even if it was considered to be a fine, we still don't think it would count. Because you may remember last year we did have a case where at least some of the tax court judges believe that a civil fine could very well run into Eighth Amendment issues. That was actually when they were reviewing whether or not there was an Eighth Amendment problem with Section 280 Cap E for marijuana distributors. And they basically held, even though the entire court held that it wasn't a problem, most of them said what was said here, that it couldn't be a penalty, couldn't be a fine for Eighth Amendments. Some said a tax could be, but they hadn't proven it was here. And some others said, like, could it be? It would be, but they hadn't shown it was excessive. So, yeah, it's still kind of an issue that we got out here. But the court said, well, we got to look at five things. So the first thing is, what's the amount of penalty Congress authorized? And they said, well, look, the IRS is charging less than the authorized penalty. And secondly, the penalty that Congress has authorized, we assume those penalties are constitutional. There's a strong presumption that Congress, you know, gets it right. In essence, you have to have a pretty hefty amount of evidence to show that it's an unconstitutionally burdensome penalty. They said, you guys didn't come close to that anyway. They also then look at, well, is this fine being applied to, you know, the class of people that the statute was designed for it to go after? This guy was actively hiding bank accounts overseas. The court said, well, that means he's not this kind of accidental thing where it's a technical violation, you know, and he's not really who it's meant for. It's like, nah, it's clearly meant for him. They talk about, too, the nature of the defense and the harm caused by the conduct. This is where the court really gets into things. And what the court says at this point is, look, there is far more damage from failing to report your foreign bank accounts to the government and to the fisc and to the fisc than simply the amount of taxes you escape. The fact that we have lots of taxpayers actively hiding funds overseas makes it very difficult and expensive for the service to try to do the enforcement there. They said, look, part of the cost of that enforcement is there. And, you know, in order to help cut down on that cost, we need to greatly discourage it. And you discourage it by making the fines very high for those that get caught. Because, you know, it used to be, it's a line which I remember I've heard an A&A instructor for years talk about, you know, when he talks about rules. And he says, look, with rules, there, you know, you might violate them. But when you violate a rule, you look at two things. You know, when he talks about like driving too fast down a freeway, what's the chance you're going to get caught, and what's the penalty for getting caught? If the penalty for going over the speed limit on an interstate is going to be a $5,000 fine, you're probably never coming near the speed limit, right? And that's the catch here. The problem here is because the chance of getting caught is going to be relatively low in many of these cases, the actual penalty needs to be relatively high to discourage people from, you know, having those sorts of excessive, you know, amounts offshore, or deciding putting money offshore and not reporting the income is a good idea. So they said, hey, look, guys, we're there. That's not the issue. And then they also do, they compare this with other penalties that could have been applied with imprisonment. They said, look, Congress has a separate criminal statute. That statute's a higher penalty than this. And, you know, losing half the account is still probably better than facing long-term imprisonment, which clearly would be an option here. They said, yeah, we're not buying this whole Eighth Amendment issue. It doesn't count. So bottom line, another taxpayer loses, and, you know, failing to get the FBAR stuff is a problem. And you need to make sure the clients have all answered that question, do I have a foreign bank account? Because as I noted, we have had a lot of court cases where getting Schedule B, and I think that's part of the reason why I don't even see it argued here, that failing to fill in Schedule B, you know, failing to say I didn't read Schedule B, or, you know, the accountant signed it, that is such a failed option that you just have to try to be sure that you understand you don't go there. You know, the clients, you've got to have the client say openly, I did not, you know, have a bank account offshore. And we all know there's a group of clients that are not going to fill in the questions on the organizer. And that means you're probably going to have to call them and ask them the question and get them to say, yes, I don't have the offshore bank account. Next up is a case where the tax court looks at the issue of when can a taxpayer argue substance over form. This is the case of Complex Media Inc. versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2021-14. And the actual facts of this case are rather messy and complicated. The actual decision runs over 100 pages in the PDF version that the tax court published, so not a short decision. But the underlying issue we're looking at here is not so much the complexities of the case, which are kind of amusing because the court ends up being asked to decide this under Section 351, which is the tax-free incorporation. But the court points out early on that even though both the IRS and the taxpayer seem to think that that's in some way relevant to the answer in this case, it still never appears that we ever had 80% control. You know, and so it's like, well, yeah, it's kind of like we got a mess here is how it works. But, you know, everybody's kind of trying to follow it, so we'll see. In any event, this transaction is a little bit weird, right? And so that's going to play into it. Now let's talk about the substance over form theory. Substance over form says that, look, you know, we got this transaction and it does all these various things. But, you know, even though on paper, right, the form of the transaction says it's this. And in this case, the question is going to become, we have essentially a subsidiary that's formed, receives the assets of the company we're going to be taking over, right? And then those assets, that subsidiary, and we're a partnership, put all of our assets into the sub. We then put all of the sub's assets, then we get all the acquired assets, put them in here, and then we're going to distribute stock out to our shareholders. Well, the catch was that one of the partners, because the initial thing is a partnership that's actually doing the acquiring, and it will become a corporation when we finish. But that partnership, one of the partners apparently could not get along with a partner of a, you know, of the company being, or the one of the owners of the company being acquired, and apparently wanted this acquired company. So bottom line, they come up with a way to try to redeem him out. And their problem was they needed the cash from the company being acquired to get the cash to redeem this guy out. So what they did was they formed the new sub, they transferred the assets into the sub, they then distributed the stock from the sub up to the partnership, so all the partners got their stock, and then they turned around and technically redeemed the shares at the same day from the guy who was leaving. Now, various reasons why it was structured that way, but that's kind of the mess that we're looking at here. Now, why is it difficult for a taxpayer? Well, a taxpayer is in control of the transaction and is in control of the form. The taxpayer, you know, in this case, the taxpayer, you know, the parties who were involved, the acquiring company, the to-be-acquired company, they were setting up and sitting down and, you know, laying out the form of the transaction. The IRS is able to challenge form over substance because they're not there for the form. The taxpayer has a tougher time doing it because, well, if you really wanted to be treated way B, why didn't you structure it as way B? And, you know, and to be honest, as we're going to talk about here, some circuits, and this is something the tax court will note, that there are definitely circuit court of appeals out there. Specifically, they will talk about, in this case, the Third Circuit and the Fifth Circuit. And I make a reference in the materials we talked about before, late 2019, that we had a Ninth Circuit case that held the same thing. You know, that in fact, in the Ninth Circuit case, that you just can't do, taxpayers can't do substance over form. And for all practical purposes, the Third and the Fifth Circuit have said so for the reasons I basically outlined. It's like, you guys choose it, don't come back to us and whine that, well, you know, I looked at it and I want to treat it differently. But the tax court isn't quite as sure that's right. So they said, well, we've talked about before why, you know, taxpayers have a tougher time with this, but we never actually explained what they had to prove. And so they're saying, you know what, and we talked about whether it was more evidence or something than the IRS. They said, no, here's the key difference. So the tax court attempted to clarify this. They said, the way the IRS can raise a substance over form issue is they just need to prove one thing, carry one issue, that in fact the economic substance of the transaction is in line with their view and that the form lacks economic substance. So the form of the transaction lacks economic substance, so we are able to, you know, ignore that form. We're the IRS. The taxpayer, obviously, no economic substance. Generally, the IRS is saying, look, that was all done to achieve this tax effect that it can't really be achieved in this realm. So we're going to go ahead and we're going to just kind of, you know, say that, yeah, we weren't consulted. This is unfair. They're dodging. This is not really happening, what they're claiming. So we get to restructure it. But the taxpayer, they said, okay, the taxpayer, if they're going to try to claim substance over form, first thing is they do have to carry that first issue. If the form reflects economic substance, there you just cannot do it. It's not the taxpayer, I don't care, the taxpayer wants another result. If there's economic substance to what they're showing, they get, you know, basically they have to live with it. But secondly, even if there's economic substance, right, even if there's a problem with the economic substance of the form, they said taxpayers still have another burden to meet in order to be able to undo the form that they set up, right? They're going to have to be able to show, right, that the transaction was not chosen for the purpose of establishing tax benefits either to the taxpayer before the tax court or to a counterparty. And that would often happen, right? You know, we decided to do a stock purchase, which is kind of how this one looks, you know, to get a better deal for the other party because selling stock would be better for them than, you know, doing something else. So the first thing we got to do is say that the form we're trying to get rid of, and in this case, actually, it doesn't affect that counterparty. The party who is primarily affected is going to be the guy being redeemed, and the court goes through why that makes no real difference, depending on which way we look at this. And so for practical purposes, that's why they're going to go along with this, right? So they have to show that we do it, right? So that is, right, that in essence, nobody here is getting a tax benefit from the current structure. If anybody is, you know, and like I said, because you went, you bought stock instead of assets because that would allow the other party to have a stock sale and get a much better treatment, yeah, you're stuck. Now, the question is going to come up with, does this make a difference? Well, if, and I think this is one where you as a tax professional are going to have to take a little look here. You've got to take a look and see What does the circuit to which this is going to be appealed? Have they ruled on the substance over form argued by the taxpayer theory? The tax court makes it pretty clear, if you read this decision, you know, that obviously there is case law out there that has been interpreted to bar it entirely. And so we need to kind of be sure we're not in that problem. I mean, in some circuits, this case obviously is a Second Circuit case. So in the Second Circuit, New York, Connecticut, you're probably going to be okay going down the tax court's analysis in this regard, at least till the Second Circuit were to rule. But yeah, if you're in the Third Circuit, so like I said, you're not in New York, but in New Jersey, right? New York Second Circuit, New Jersey's Third. If you're in New Jersey, you got a much bigger problem because the Third Circuit is one of the strict circuits that says, taxpayers, you just can't argue this. And it's not likely, I don't think, reading the opinion, that we're going to see those circuits change their view. I don't think it's going to change the Ninth Circuit's view. I don't see it changing the Fifth or the Third, right? So be aware and be careful. But at least it tells you, in some cases, if you're in the right circuit, you may be able to, with your taxpayer going to tax court, go substance over form if there's a reason to do it, but you have to clear this issue. You've got to show that nobody is better off from the tax standpoint because of the structure you're using, and therefore you can change that structure without risking the IRS getting whipsawed. So even under this condition, it's not going to be super easy. Finally, let's take a look at the IRS's news release, IR 2021-34. This is a news release labeled IRS Summit Partners Issue Urgent EFIN Scam Alert to Tax Professionals. Remember, the Security Summit is that group of tax professionals, tax software groups, and state tax agencies and the IRS. So what's happening is there's an email currently being sent out that the IRS has become aware of. And reads like something that is met, which is these days is something you see quite often. It sounds like it's a security email. To provide security, you need to take the following steps. And in fact, it says, in order to protect both you and your clients from unauthorized fraudulent activities, the IRS requires that you verify all authorized e-file originators prior to transmitting returns through our system. That means we need your EFIN verification and driver's license before you e-file. Okay. Now, we're all used to getting something like that, right? I think all of us have, you know, we're going to our provider, like you're going to Thomson Reuters, you're going to CCH, you're going to Intuit. You often provide that sort of information to show, right, that, hey, we're author, you know, we have to prove we're an authorized party. So this isn't that unusual. Obviously, where they're going to have you send it is where they're going to foul this up, but they know we're used to it. And the real interesting part, you know, the letter claims to come from the IRS. It actually has an address at the bottom that's an address, a physical address, you know, physical street address. There's actually a street address of Intuit in Tucson, which is kind of interesting. Now, that Tucson address, I remember my history here. I believe it's set up early on. It was part of, I think, when TurboTax was still part of a company called ChipSoft, that was acquired by Intuit, the personal finance company. And then eventually, of course, TurboTax became, they got rid of Quicken, which was really their big product. And eventually now they have the tax software and QuickBooks. That's Intuit these days. But that address is down there. And I'm sure part of that is to make it look normal, right? You're used to seeing that and you might not notice where it's going, right? So it says, please have a current PDF copy or image of your EFIN acceptance letter within the last 12 months, or a copy of your EFIN application summary found at your e-services account, IRS.gov, in front and back of your driver's license, emailed, okay, there's the first point, like, wait, emailed my driver's license, right, to complete the verification process with a fake email address. Now, that second paragraph is one that, honestly, if you were kind of going along with the first paragraph, the second paragraph should have caught your attention. That's like, wait, why would you email it? If you're even now the threat, right? In order to get people to do these things, we've got to request the data, come up with a plausible reason to need it, and then we've got to panic people so they don't think about it. So what they say is, again, this came out this week, just as getting ready to start the e-file season. If your EFIN is not verified by our system, your ability to e-file will be disabled until you provide the documentation showing your credentials are in good standing to e-file with the IRS. It's copyright 2021 e-file. Don't know who e-file is, but that's what it's copyright to. All rights reserved and trademarks. I'm not sure what, I guess that means they have trademarks, would be their theory. You know, okay. I don't really say. And then it gives that address in Tucson, right? Which again, does map to an Intuit physical street address. But this email is not from Intuit, not from any tax provider. Now, if you receive this email, the IRS wants you to A, don't respond to it, right? B, send it as an attachment to phishing@irs.gov, notify TIGTA to report the IRS personation scam, and they're investigating. The idea behind this, of course, is to try to get your credentials and your driver's license could make it easier, you know, in secondary verification, try to figure out who's really you. Right. Remember, we're starting to ask for driver's license numbers now. So they're starting to try to ask and acquire those as well. They also remind us about other scams that are going around. There are other scams trying to get e-fins from professionals. Also, please remember, and you've all should have seen these, this has been going on for a few years. Remember the, quote, new client scam, where they want to get you signed up as a new client. They offer to send you some documents, and they're not really going to send you documents. They're going to send you what's malware, or malware-laced documents, which you could do in a PDF too. But in many cases, it just fails to open. Oh, I got it wrong. You know, something like that, whatever. And then, you know, it doesn't get there. But that allows them to install backdoors on your system, which then can be used to file returns. So we got to do those things, right? They also have phishing scams for ransomware, where if you click on the email, ransomware comes in. They'll ask for you to pay the ransom. And the flip side of that is, as you may know, and this is the problem, while they're going to hold your data hostage, you know, A, they don't necessarily always give you the unlock code if you pay. And B, even if they do, they have all the data. So again, your client's data is severely compromised, at least we have to assume, if you fall victim to that. So they are warning you about the fact that, again, tax professionals are being targeted. So be careful out there, guys. It's getting dangerous, right? Because again, all this stuff and the general warning. Well, it's another week and we're in tax season. They're accepting e-filed returns right now. And they've even had a couple accepted. Well, I still don't have the state of Arizona accepting them, but they got submitted here just recently. So got a couple of returns out there for acceptance and we'll see if they actually get accepted. For Arizona, we'll do it, but the feds have got them done. So we will talk about what's coming up. We do have a bill moving in the House. It is moving under the reconciliation provision. So that does mean that they're moving a bill that, if necessary, could move without any support, from the other side of the aisle. That's less of a problem in the House because any bill could clear the House, if only Democrats have to vote for a bill in the House for anything because a simple majority can take care of anything in the House, just like until we got to 2015, right? Or I should say not 2015, until we got to 2018 and 2019, 2018 election, 2019 tax, 2019 years, Republicans could clear the House without a majority, but the Senate needs 40 votes. Normally needs at least no more than 40 votes against to get something to the floor, except in reconciliation. So we do have a reconciliation bill out. It would make some changes to some personal credits. It would give you the $1,400 additional check. It would have a few other things involved in it. It would extend, which I think one of the big ones for us, the employee retention credit would be extended for the entire year in the current proposal. So, be aware of it. What clears finally is kind of open. And the question is, since they cannot lose a single Democratic vote in the Senate, if they have no Republican votes, they cannot lose one because it'd be 50-50. A 50-50 vote if all Democrats vote for it, and then the vice president would break the tie. So bottom line, any Democrat in the Senate has a veto power over the bill. So when you hear a lot of people are asking Joe Manchin about what he's going to do, because the assumption is that Joe's going to be the one, if anybody's breaking, it'll be Joe on certain issues and that he may force them to make some changes to the bill. So we need to keep an eye on that. So we'll keep an eye on that bill, see what's happening, see if it makes retroactive changes to last year, which would be even more fun. And otherwise, keep an eye on what's happening here in taxes and what happens going forward. But otherwise, hopefully you're now ready. You're in tax season. My guess is we will not have a whole lot of continuing education courses coming up until after April 15th at this point. I'll do a couple of, like I said, very short one-hour courses I think I'm scheduled to do on a couple of occasions coming up, but that's it. You know, nothing else is coming. If a huge major tax bill came in out of this, and I'm not sure what I see proposed currently be major enough to actually, you know, stop everything and say, yeah, we got a whole special course, but those are possible. But again, most likely we're coming back after tax season with courses, so we'll see where we're at. Otherwise, we'll watch for you, and hopefully you come back here next week, and we'll talk more about what's happening in the area of federal tax developments.